Good morning. Well, it's great to be back together in worship. Last week during our Easter celebration, it was just so exciting to see all of us coming together and just giving praise to God and giving people a chance to respond to the gospel. And last week in our services, we had about 170 people, 167 people indicate that they trusted Christ for the first time. And so we're so excited about that. And we spent the week following up, meeting with people, trying to help them take their next steps spiritually, and it's just so exciting to see God working in our church, working in our midst, and using us to bring the message of the gospel to people, and then helping them take their steps spiritually. So we're just so excited about that. And this morning we're diving back into our Collide series. We've been looking at the Psalms, and understanding that in every one of the Psalms that is kind of a song that flows out of the lives of the people that wrote these down, there's this collision that takes place. There's the brutal honesty of my life experience that frequently collides with my understanding of who God is and what God is doing. And we're going to look at that this morning in Psalm 139. So I'd encourage you to grab your Bibles, turn to Psalm 139. While you're turning there, I just want to pause and kind of tell you some of the things I've been thinking about this week. I don't know how many of you guys grew up in a kind of a Sunday school church where you learn songs that were very helpful sometimes in your theology. And so I can still remember some of them, you know. The wise man built his house upon the rock. We did all the little motions and the rain came tumbling down. We sang all that. And then some of them were so theologically intense, I still don't know what they mean. You know, deep and wide, there's a fountain flowing deep and wide. Like, what's that all about? I didn't really know. But one of the songs that's always stuck out in my head that reminds me of this psalm that just, you know, kind of reverberates with me is, "Oh, be careful, little eyes." What you see? Anybody know the tune to that? "Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see. Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see. For the..." Now, this is the part that was always hard for me. "For the Father up above is looking down in love. So be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little hands, what you do. Be careful, little feet, where you go." So, you know, I sing that song. And on the one hand, there was a part of me that was kind of like, that's so cool that God is really tuned in and paying attention. And then there was a part of me that was going, oh, no. Like, God is really tuned in and paying attention. You know, kind of gave me that feel, the song we used to sing when we were kids, "I'm getting nothing for Christmas." Because I ain't been nothing but bad. And then all the song goes through all the bad things the little boy did and somebody snitched on him. This kind of gave me that feeling that God is looking down on me. And so, uh-oh, he sees everything I do. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? In other words, when we look at the fact that God knows everything about us, does that feel like a blessing? Or does that feel like some kind of a restriction? How does that feel? Well, that's what the collision or the problem that David is struggling with in this Psalm 139. And so as we look at this psalm together, and a lot of people look at the psalm and they see just kind of a surface reading, like wonderful, everything's great. But when you look below the surface, David is wrestling with this. The intimate knowledge of God that he has over my life, do I view that as something that hinders me from life, keeps me from experiencing what I want to do, keeps me in the doghouse with God? Or does the fact that God knows everything about my life, does that indicate his love for me? And is that a good thing? So let's look at the psalm together. As we look at Psalm 139, this is again a psalm of David. And the psalm is divided up into four stanzas. Each of the six verses make up a stanza. And each one of the six verses, those stanzas, speak to a characteristic of God. Okay, so when we look at the first one here, starting in verses 1, going through verse 6, the first principle that we see is that God knows everything about me. Now, theologically, we call that omniscience. Okay, God knows everything. So what does that look like when it comes to me? Starting in verse 1, it says, "O Lord, you have searched me and you know me." That word search means that he's done a careful, diligent, thorough search. And the word know there, the Hebrew word yada, means to know at an experiential level. In other words, God doesn't just have your bio. He doesn't simply have your resume. He doesn't simply have a list of your accomplishments. He knows you personally. It's kind of like sisters and brothers, you know? A sister has lived with her brother for 15, 16, 17 years, and she kind of knows. Like, here's what he's like. Here's his tendencies. After a while, you know, maybe she can even figure out what's going to come out of his mouth next. Like, what is he going to say? How's he going to respond in certain situations? That's what this word know means. That God knows me. He knows everything about me. In fact, the psalmist goes on to describe in verse 2 that God knows our actions. He knows when I sit and when I rise. Now, for those of you who are English majors or you teach English, the figure of speech here is a merism. A merism takes the two opposites and points them both out as a figure of speech to say that everything in the middle is also included. So God knows when I sit and he knows when I stand up. So like pretty much all the actions of my life, God is aware of every one of those. And then he goes on to say, you perceive my thoughts from afar. In other words, you know my motives. Like from the distance of heaven to earth, you can see right inside of me, into my heart, into my head, and you know what my motives are for my actions. So you not only know what I do, you know why I do it. I don't know about you, but that's pretty intimate. You know, we always walk around and we think, well, you know, if people could just see my heart. I mean, they would know that, like what I just said, you know, even though it was really rude and kind of hurt your feelings, you really in my heart, you would know that I would never feel that way. Well, God knows what's in your heart. He probably knows what's in your heart better than you know what's in your heart. He knows those things. He goes on to say, you discern in verse 3 my goings out and my lyings down. In other words, you discern my goings out, my lyings down. You are familiar with all my ways. In other words, all my activities, whether I'm leaving the house, whether I'm coming in, whether I'm going out, whether I'm finished for the day, I'm you know, leave for work in the morning or come back at night, and I'm going to bed. You know all of that. You're familiar with all my activities. And before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. In other words, not only do you know what I say, but you know what I say before I even say it. Like, I don't know about you, but that's pretty comprehensive. God knows every single thing about you. He knows every single thing about me. That's hard to get our mind around. In trying to kind of get a feel for what this looks like or feels like, Hollywood has tried to kind of capture some of the humor of how we think about God. And in the movie Bruce Almighty, Bruce is really ticked off at God because things aren't going right in his life. So he starts blaming God for the details of his life, kind of assuming that God is not paying attention to the details. And when God, in the form of Morgan Freeman, comes to meet with Bruce and begins to explain that intimate knowledge, a real humorous moment occurs. Let's watch it together.
Murray, what is this? How do you know my father, and how'd you get my pager number?
Oh, I know quite a lot about you, Bruce. Just about everything there is to know. Everything you've ever said, or done, or thought about doing. Right there in that file cabinet.
Wow, a whole drawer just for me.
Yeah.
Mind if I take a look?
Sure, like.
This ought to be good.
Last entry was a little disturbing. The gloves are off, God. God has taken my bird and my bush. God is a mean kid with a magnifying glass. Smite me, O mighty smiter. Now, I'm not much for blaspheming, but that last one made me laugh.
Are you spying on me? Who are you?
I'm the one.
Huh? So, as Bruce is not really believing that God is really God or that Morgan Freeman is really God, I mean, he goes on to really criticize him and talk about how much he hates God and how bad God is. And in response to that, God confronts him with a little bit more knowledge about who he is. Watch this.
Oh. You've been doing a lot of complaining about me, Bruce. And quite frankly, I'm tired of it.
Wait. Don't come near me. Seriously, when I'm backed into a corner, I'm like a wild animal. I don't want to hurt you, but I will out of instinct.
You haven't won a fight since grade 5, and that was against a girl.
Yeah, she was huge. She'd been held back.
And the sun was in your eyes. Oh, the ego. Anyway, I brought you here to offer you a job.
A job? What job?
My job. You think you can do it better, so here's your chance. When you leave this building, you will be endowed with all my powers.
Whatever you say, Bill.
The rest of the movie convinces everybody that it's a good thing God is God and none of us are, because we would really not do well at this. God knows every single thing about all of us. That's omniscience. God knows everything about us. Now, how does the psalmist feel about this? David, how do you feel about this? Notice what he says in verse 5. He says, "You hem me in behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful me, too lofty for me to attain it." That word hemmed means to be confined or to be besieged. And he says, "You hem me in behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me." Literally what he's describing is it kind of feels to me, God, like your knowledge of me and your interaction in my life, your involvement, is kind of like somebody who puts their hands around me, like you've got your hands around me, and I am cupped in your hands, and I can't escape. I am hemmed in. And when I think about that, it just blows my mind to think that everything about me and everything I do and everything I say and everywhere I go, you have access to that, you're involved in that. He says, "This is too wonderful for me." Now, we tend to think of the word wonderful in a real positive way. The word wonderful means to be awe-inspiring. It means to be mind-blowing. It means to be beyond comprehension. And he says, "This is too hard for me to attain." In other words, trying to get a grip on the implications of what that means, that you are there with me all the time, is so hard, I can't climb it. That phrase, "too hard to attain," is literally the concept of scaling a fortress wall. And David is a mighty soldier, understands what it takes to get an army up over a wall, over the fortress wall. And he's saying, when I think about this, I can't fathom how I would even begin to tackle getting my mind around all this. He's kind of struggling with this. Is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? And in the next section, we see he kind of gets a little bit nervous with it. The second principle that we see coming out of the next six verses is that God is everywhere. And we call this omnipresent. It's the theological world. God is present, or God is everywhere. He knows everything, and he is everywhere. Notice what David says in verse 7. David says, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" In other words, like when I feel hemmed in, my natural inclination, my collide moment, is I want to get away. I want to find a place where I can hide from you, where I'm not accountable to you, where you don't know what I'm doing, where you don't know what's going on in my life. Where can I flee from your presence? And then he goes into it again. He says, "If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there." In other words, if I go all the way to heaven or go all the way to hell, all the way to heaven or all the way to the grave, like, and everything in between, that's how far I would have to go, and I still wouldn't be able to get away from you. And then he says the next verse, he says, "If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast." Now, look at that phrase, it's really cool. He says, "If I rise on the wings of the dawn." Now, David's standing in the area of Palestine when he looks to the east, right? Looks where the dawn comes from. He would turn and look back across the desert. And what he's saying is, if I rise on the wings of the dawn, in other words, in the morning, when the sun peaks up and the rays of the sun start to come across the horizon, it feels like wings to me. He said, if I got up there with the sun and rode on the back of the sun like a bird and flew all the way over to the sea. Now, where does the sun set? If David turns west, he's looking at the Mediterranean. He's saying, if I were able to get up with the sun in the morning from the horizon and fly all the way across to the other side, land on the other side, in other words, go from one horizon to the other. Now, in David's day, without rocket ships, without airplanes, without fast cars and ninja motorcycles, travel was pretty slow. Like, you get on a camel, maybe you get a fast horse. Most of the time you're walking. The idea that the sun could go from there all the way to there in just one day was mind-boggling. And what David is saying is, if I could go from one horizon and fly as fast as the sun can cover to go all the way to the other horizon, guess what? I can't get away. So no matter how far I go, heaven or hell, no matter how fast I go, as fast as from one side of the earth to the other side of the earth, I can't get away from you. You're still there. You're everywhere. He says in verse 10, he says, even there, your hand will guide me. Now, David's starting to feel a little bit of a change. This is starting to feel a little bit better to him. Maybe, God, it's a good thing that you know my life, because then you can lead me in a good path. He says, there, your right hand will hold me fast. And then he gives us some insight in the next verse. He says, if I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light will become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like day, for darkness is as light to you. Now that phrase in verse 11, surely the darkness will hide me, has an ominous tone. Some people even translate this, surely the darkness will bruise me. In other words, what David is saying is that when I walk in the dark, I stumble, I fall. Robbers and thieves steal at night. Murderers kill at night. There are dangers lurking in the dark that I can't see. But even there, you can see in the dark. See what David is beginning to say? Well, maybe I don't know all that I need to know. Maybe the fact that you know everything is a good thing for me. Maybe I can't go everywhere to be everywhere to make sure everything's taken care of, but maybe the fact that you are everywhere is actually a benefit to me. It's a good thing to me. Now, this progression is not that different than what you experience when you're raising children, okay? So any of you here have raised children, maybe you got a little brother or sister, maybe you've observed raising children. The progression of a child is that when they're young and when they're small, what do they want? They want attention, right? Mom, Dad, pay attention to me. Watch me. See what I can do. They also want to be known. They're constantly talking, telling you things, asking you questions, following you around. So wherever mom and dad goes, kids are following you around. What do they want? They want the intimacy and security of your presence. And then something happens. They reach a point where they desire independence. And once they reach a point where they begin to develop or explore this concept of independence, then try to get your 13, 14, 15-year-old son to tell you how their day went. Like, Mom, Dad, I don't talk anymore. Leave me alone. You don't need to know what I did. You don't need to know who I talked to. It's my life, okay? So I don't come home and share anymore. When Dad's reading the paper or working on the computer, they don't come up and start going, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. Some of you guys would say, you know, I'm really glad we kind of got through that phase. Other ones would say, I don't have a clue where my kids are at. I had to get on Facebook so I could find out what my kids are doing, and they won't even friend me. Like, they don't want me to know what's going on with them. When we view mom and dad as a source of intimacy, a source of security, someone who takes care of me, someone who knows more, then we want to be known. We want to be close. We want to talk. We want them to see everything we're doing. When we view mom and dad as a hindrance to our freedom, like I want to go, I want to do, I want to have fun, I do not want mom and dad micromanaging me. I believe the technology industry has got this cycle figured out. I don't know if you noticed this or not, but the first thing that comes out is a piece of technology that gives your kids freedom. And they market it to you as if you really need this for your kids because they're going to act in freedom, and you really need to know where they are. So you buy cell phones for all your kids, and then all of a sudden you find out actually that cell phone is giving them a lot more freedom. They can make a lot of plans. They can talk to a lot of strange people. They can be in a lot of places rendezvousing now that they've got that technology. So the companies come out with new technology, GPS tracking systems for that phone, so they can tell where you are. You know, the next thing kids are going to be doing is they'll say they're going to go to the mall. They'll put all their phones in somebody's purse, and she'll go to the mall, and they'll go do what they want to do. They will always outsmart you, mom and dad. They just will. Because when you want freedom, some of you are going, I wonder if that's what happened this weekend. Bought that GPS system. Those technology companies have got it figured out. What were they doing? If you want freedom, that feeling of control. But then someday, at some point in time, kids grow up. And at some age out there, you know, 29, 35, all of a sudden they realize, man, wasn't it great that mom and dad cared about me, were interested in what I was doing. They wanted to keep me from getting in trouble. They really have a lot of insight. Parents gain so much wisdom between ages about 16 and about 26. It's not actually your wisdom. It's your children's wisdom that you gain during that time. I mean, you learn, right, that your parents really had good intentions, and what they were trying to tell you and what they were trying to do was for your benefit. And at some point in time, you kind of come back to that desire for intimacy. Now, that is really, really moved forward in the process when you get in trouble. Because when you get in trouble, teenagers, who do you call? Mom, Dad, come bail me out. And I think that's what David is experiencing here. He's starting to say, oh man, there are a lot of dangers out there in the dark. A lot of places I could mess up, I could get hurt. God, maybe fleeing from you is not a bad thing. Maybe you knowing everything about me everywhere all the time is really for my own good. It's for my own protection. Which leads David into a major contemplation about where he came from. Starting in verse 13 and moving forward, we see the third principle, and that is that God formed my body and planned my life. God formed my body and planned my life. We talk here about God as being the creator. He's the maker of everything. And in this really intimate passage, here's what David comes to. He says, for, like, you protect me, no darkness is light to you. For, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. What David is saying is that before I breathed my first breath and came into the light, when I was in the darkness of my mother's womb, even in the darkness, it's not dark to you, God. You see in there. In fact, you not only saw me in my mother's womb before I was born, but you participated in creating me. That was something that you did. That word, you knit me together, is kind of the idea of putting together a piece of fabric, sewing all of the pieces together, is saying that God was actually involved in that process of actually shaping my body. And when I think about the very nature of creation, and everybody that's held a baby in their arms has experienced that, you look at this miracle to think that God was actually involved in putting this child together before we ever saw it, before it ever was born, before it ever came into the world. That reminds me, God, that you have actually brought me into being. It's because of you that I have life in the first place. You sewed me together, brought me into the world. And that would imply that what you're going to do with my life, you have good intentions for me. What you want for me is you want something positive, something beautiful, something magnificent to come out of this life. You didn't just make me to mock me. You made me for a purpose. He goes on to say in verse 14, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. He says, my frame was not hidden from you. The word frame there is literally the word bone or bones. He's saying my physical structure was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together. That phrase woven is the word for embroidery. In other words, the embroidery, those of you guys have seen somebody who takes all the different colors of thread and creates a beautiful picture. And every single loop of the colored thread goes into just its perfect place to paint a picture. He says, God, you were actually kind of framing me up, shaping me, making me look the way I am and to be the way I am. I think this is the greatest passage on self-esteem. It's not Hollywood that sets the standard for who you ought to be. It's God Himself who created you. So you know that weird dimple that you have? This passage implies that God was actually giving you that. You know those excessively large feet that you always looked at, or the skinny legs, and you looked at those and you always wondered, like, why am I so weird? Why am I smarter than everybody else? Or why am I not so smart, but people just like me? Where did all this come from? God has a purpose for everybody's life, and He built you in a custom way to accomplish that purpose. And some of you have spent your entire life loathing that. You spent your entire life loathing that, wishing you were somebody else, wishing you looked like someone else, wishing you were built like someone else, and you've given your life to that. Why don't I have these abilities, and I'm stuck with these over here, while somebody else is stuck with these, and they're wondering why they don't have yours? And we do that. And this passage is saying, stop it. Explore why I made you the way I made you. Explore that. Learn about that. That's the only productive thing that's going to make a difference. Wishing I was someone else will never make me someone else. No matter how much plastic surgery I might apply, it'll never make me someone else. Let that go. Be beautiful in the way God created you and stay with that. Now, let me just send you on a little search. There's a myth out there that the most attractive people, by whatever standard they measure, those are the happiest people in life. Do you think that's true? You think that's true? I'm going to encourage you to go research that. Go research who are the happiest people. You're going to find out that there's a lot of products and thigh masters and other things like that that are being sold to try to get you to buy into this myth that people that have been blessed by God with stunning beauty are somehow more happy and more successful in life. That's why, you know, I have such a difficult time. You know, when I see Brad Pitt, and I look at him, and I look at Bill Gates, I can't tell them apart. The guys look identical. Right? Right? Just think if Bill Gates would have looked like Brad Pitt. We'd all be using Macs right now, right? Right? God made you. Accept it. That's part of his love. He created you. And not only did he create you, he created you for a purpose. What it says in 16, he says, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. David says, you know, you got my life. Like, you got the events of my life, the circumstances, the length of my life. That's all part of what you've done here when you made me. And in response to that, verse 17, he says, how precious to me are your thoughts. Now, this is really important. The word precious there means valuable. Like, however much money that I might think is important, like, your thoughts are more important to me. However much praise I might receive in my life, however much power, however many degrees I might have, the things that I would consider valuable, the most significant things to me, you know what's more valuable to me than all of those other things? They're your thoughts. Your thoughts, oh God. The word thoughts there refers to God's plans, his intentions, his motivations, his purposes. In other words, what David is saying is discovering your will for my life is the most valuable thing that I could ever do. In other words, God, if you created my life and you gave me my days and you shaped the course of my life, the best thing I could do, the most valuable thing I could do would be to figure out what you want me to do. What's your purpose for me? Because that's what's really going to give me happiness. That's what's really going to give me peace. That's what's really going to make me significant. It's not following my father's plan for my life or my mother's plan for my life. It's not following society's plan for my life or my boyfriend's plan for my life or my girlfriend's plan for my life. It's not following my coach's plan for my life. The most valuable thing to me is figuring out what you have planned for my life. And following your plan. And so that lifelong search of God, you know everything about me, so get me on track, help me follow you. That's what's really going to be valuable. He says, how precious are your thoughts? Oh God, how vast is the sum of them? Like when you think about that God has a plan for every person on the planet, 6 billion plus, that's a lot of plans, right? That's a lot of thoughts. And so he goes on to say, were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. Like, you know, God, you've got so many plans for all of these people that you created. You've got so many ideas. It's mind-boggling to think that you could be tuned in to what Jim's life is all about and all the details and what Sue's life is all about and what Betty's life is all about, that you could have all that and be thinking of me. That's why Jesus says, in Matthew 10, 29 through 31, he asked the question. He said, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Sparrow, it's worth a half a penny. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. Even the least valuable living thing on the planet, God's tuned into that. He goes on to say, and even the very hairs on your head are numbered. So don't be afraid, you are worth more than many sparrows. God knows every detail about you, including your hair count this morning. He understands those things. You talk about a number of things to keep up with. God's a lot bigger than you might think. David goes on to say, when I awake, that's from his meditation, when I awake, I'm still with you. Like, no matter where I go, what I do, even when I'm just pondering, like when I come out of it, like it's you and me, you're still there. And then in verse 19, David takes a turn. It says, if only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak evil of you with evil intent. Or they speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? But I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. In the midst of all that, David's like so into God right here that he starts to look at the people who are against God, and all of a sudden, his righteous indignation, his hatred of those people, boils to the surface. And what are we talking about here? We're talking about this attribute or characteristic of God, that God is holy. Okay, God is holy in every way. And I define holy for you on your outline there is holy implies that there is no flaw. God is untainted in every way. Now, that's not true for us. That's not true for us. We are tainted. That's part of the problem. And so God reveals and refines us from our painful faults. Now, let me just speak a word about enemies, and then we'll come back and finish this up. There are all kinds of places in the Psalms where David says things like, God, will you kill my enemies? Will you burn their houses, smash their babies, and all kinds of things like that? And we go, whoa, what is that all about? That's a great question. I'm going to do a whole message on that in 2 weeks. Okay, so 2 weeks from now, we're going to look at this whole conundrum of love your enemies, wish bad on your enemies, and a lot of us don't really know what to do with that. I mean, we see people in our culture that are really anti the things of God, and we don't know how to respond to that. And the psalmist feels pretty aggressive here, so we're going to do a whole message on the imprecatory psalms. And you learn your new word for today. And so I'm going to postpone addressing these particular verses because I want to get to the conclusion of the passage. David is talking about those people who don't understand and embrace God's holiness. While he's talking about those people that don't understand and embrace God's holiness, he recognizes that maybe he's not perfect either. Verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Now let's pause and look at this. He says, God, search me. Now, God already knows everything about him. So David is not asking God to do a new search. What David is asking God to do is to continue his probing work. And now David's opened himself up. He's saying, you know, I started out thinking maybe you knowing everything about me was bad. Now I'm embracing the fact that you know everything about me. Even look deeper. Look deeper into me. Scrutinize me. Evaluate me. Speak into me. I want your eyes to look into my heart, to look into my mind, to look into my soul. In fact, he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." Now, the Hebrew concept of the heart was not the center of feelings. It was the center of thinking and acting. So, thinking and acting. He's saying, God, I want you to look into me and search my thoughts, my ideas, and then what I do with those things. So, from here to my actions, I want you to look at my whole life, what I think and what I'm doing. He goes on to say, test me and know my anxious thoughts. That word for test me literally means to refine me. It's like with metal when you heat it up so the impurities will rise to the top so that you can get them off and have pure metal. He's saying, God, I want you to refine me, test me. And in the process of that, the big area is my anxious thoughts. Now, what are anxious thoughts? Anxious thoughts are those feelings of doubt and confusion and anxiety. You know, the times when you kind of get agitated because there's a decision before you and you don't know which way to go and you kind of struggle with that. James chapter 1 verse 5 calls that the double-minded person. You know, I kind of want to follow God, but I kind of want to do my own thing. And, you know, I'm kind of back and forth. He says, what I want you to do is I want you to refine me at the areas of my anxious thoughts, the places where I'm struggling, where I don't know what to do, where I'm confused, where I'm anxious, where I can't trust you, where I'm doubting you, where I'm struggling with temptation, where I'm struggling with sin. All of those places that have not been given to your lordship. I want you to begin to refine all of those. Look into me. Know what I'm doing, know what I'm thinking, and begin to refine the areas in me where I have struggles. And then in verse 24, he pulls it all together. He says, see if there is any offensive way in me. The word offensive there means hurtful or painful. And what he's talking about is see if there's anything in me that will eventually lead to pain, or will eventually lead to hurt, both in me or in someone else. In other words, is there something that I'm thinking, or is there something that I'm doing that is damaging, that's going to cause danger to me, that will take my life off track? Is there a temptation that I'm following that will eventually undermine me, cause me pain? Is there something that I don't see, that I'm not getting? Proverbs 14:9 says, there's a way that seems right to a man, But in the end, it leads to death. Throughout the New Testament writers constantly say to us, do not be deceived. Now, why do they say that? Because there are a lot of times we're thinking we are on the right track, and we are so far off. And those of you guys who've ever done orienteering and you've worked with a compass before, you know, if you start here at this point and you're a little bit off, by the time you get way out here, you're way off. So we start back here. I'm making a decision about how I handle a relationship. I'm making a decision about what I do with my resources. I'm making a decision about how I treat someone else or the words that come out of my mouth. And I start traveling down a path. David's saying, God, keep me from traveling a path that will cause pain and harm. Let me just tell you, there are lots of you guys right now, as you sit here, you know, that the path you're traveling on is not going to lead you where you want to end up. And in your mind, you keep thinking, yeah, but there's going to come a day when I'm just going to take two steps over and get where I want to be. How wise do you think that is? How wise do you think that is? How many people have said, yeah, I'm going to take two steps over and get where I want to be, and you take two steps over, and you find out that where you want to be is a lot further over there, much further than you could ever bridge. David is saying, listen, God, I want you to expose, to bring to the surface anything in my life that I'm doing right now, anything that is going to cause pain to me or someone else. And he concludes with this phrase. He says, and lead me in the way everlasting. There is a path, there's a way that leads from here to eternity. And along the way, it has the characteristics of heaven along the way. Are we on that path? Now, there's only one who knows everything in the whole wide world, including everything about you. There's only one who's everywhere, involved in everything that's going on. There's only one who knows you personally, who took the time to shape you and give you your life. Now, would it seem wise to look to that one and say, okay, God, let's do it your way. Let's follow you. Take me down your path. Would that seem wise? What I want us to do is I want us to end this portion of our service by just pausing to ask the question, would I be willing to say, God, show me, open my eyes to anything I'm currently involved in, anything I'm doing, any attitude I'm holding on to, any behavior or motive. God, refine that and turn me back to the everlasting path. Let's just bow our heads right now. Let's bow our heads right now. And just in this quietness before God, have the courage to pray that prayer. Some of you say, Tim, I already know what it is. I already know where I'm at. I know what's going on, and I know I need to turn. Maybe you should be asking God to give you the courage to seek out some encouragement, some help. Share it with a friend, a confidant. Ask a pastor for some counseling. It's time to take those steps. Others may say, I don't see anything. God, just open my eyes. You never have to worry that God either doesn't know or he doesn't care. So if you're seeking him, he's going to get you there. Let's seek him together.
So fearfully and wonderfully made, how could they say there is no God? Reminded every breath that I take, it's by your hand I have been formed. So So what am I gonna do with this life you gave me? What could I do but live for your praise? You gave me this breath.
Say there is no